This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will visit with Alberto Ibarguen. He is president and CEO of the Knight Foundation. He will be at LSU next week as part of the centennial for the Manship School. And Alberto Ibarguen will talk about the state of news in America and news coverage. He has is a man who speaks from experience, having been at the Miami Herald when that newspaper won 3 Pulitzer Prizes. Also, who won, who lost in the battle over the budget as the doors of the federal government have reopened on Capitol Hill. Fay Williams and Clay Young will opine about this week and the aftermath. And we'll also have a preview of Uncommon Thread's 5 years of wearable art. Big showdown tomorrow night. We'll talk about that as well. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number outside our area. The number is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is Alberto Ibarguen. He is president and CEO of the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the former publisher of the Miami Herald, the fabled newspaper, which won 3 Pulitzer Prizes during the tenure of Alberto Ibarguen. Alberto is coming to Baton Rouge next week and the Manship School for the 100th anniversary of LSU's Journalism School, and he is the opening act. And good morning to you, Mr. Ibarguen.
Good morning. I actually don't think of myself as the opening act, but thank you.
Well, the topic is the future of news. What are we looking at in the world of news and news coverage?
Well, I'm not sure that anybody who gives you a definitive answer is paying attention. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah, okay. I think the closest analogy that I can give you is written about by a woman named Elizabeth Eisenstein, who taught at the University of Michigan, and she wrote about the Middle Ages, wrote about Gutenberg and the monks, and she tells the story of order. Before Gutenberg mechanizes the printing press, the monks would illuminate a manuscript or two per year, handed to the trusted priest or abbot, and there was order. Suddenly, Gutenberg mechanizes the printing press. Martin Luther basically mimeographed his theses. Everybody, any Tom, Dick, or Harry can publish a book, and for 100 years, you didn't know who to trust. This is exactly the kind of thing we're going through now with the World Wide Web that has given everybody access to Internet and to this phenomenal system of communication that fundamentally changes the way we talk to each other and changes not just how we communicate news, but how orchestras, how music is disseminated, how medicine is practiced, and there isn't a single major industry that isn't really importantly affected by this revolution in communication.
Well, how has the technology affected newspapers?
Well, the technology has affected newspapers because it has created an opportunity for a nearly infinite number of players to participate without permission. Before, there was a huge barrier to entry. When I was publisher of a newspaper, if you didn't have 3 or 4 presses, we had 7. If you didn't have 3 or 4 presses, you were not going to be able to compete with me. If you didn't have 400 reporters like we had at the Miami Herald, you couldn't possibly compete with the Miami Herald. Now, because the cost of operating is so modest, because the delivery systems are so comparatively inexpensive, because the ubiquitousness of the smartphone, anybody can get the news anywhere you want. I think it has absolutely changed the business model, so that it doesn't resemble at all what we used to know.
2975633, if you'd like to join us in our remaining moments with Alberto Ibarguen. He is president and CEO of the Knight Foundation in Miami, Florida, and former publisher of the Miami Herald. The technology has changed, and newspapers are not as lucrative as they were not so long ago. The shining example is the Boston Globe, which sold for $1.1 billion 20 years ago. Last month, or maybe the month before, it sold for $70 million. What's going on as far as the financial solvency of newspapers in this country?
I think nobody has figured out exactly what the next business model is going to be. I think it's interesting and instructive that the Boston Globe was just recently bought, as you pointed out, by a financial guy who made his money on internet trading in commodities. I think it was the Washington Post, perhaps even more famously, was just bought by the founder, the creator, and the president, the chairman of Amazon.com. I think that's good news. I think that is welcome news for the business, because I think this brings in people who are of the new medium, who are willing to try things, who are willing to focus on how people are actually getting their news, and yet still share the traditional newsroom values of investigatory journalism, of verification journalism. In other words, not merely of opinion journalism, but of journalism that attempts to be as much as humanly possible, be fact-based.
Well, the Baton Rouge Advocate was recently bought by a gentleman whose fortune is largely based on gambling and tobacco products. Does it really matter how a person got there if their intentions are good and their business model is solid?
I don't know. I don't know the gentleman you're talking about, so I can't comment about him. I can speculate that was it Nobel who made his money on armaments and munitions, and now he gives the Peace Prize, or the money from his endowment gives the Peace Prize. I think the issue is, is he buying the newspaper for his own aggrandizement, or is he buying the paper because he believes in the community and he believes that a community in a democracy must have free flow of information in order for this democratic system we have, this democratic republic that we have, must have the free flow of information for it to function effectively. And if he's doing it in order to have power by providing that information, I say great. That's what the Chandlers did in Los Angeles. That's what the Sulzbergers did. That's what the Myers and the Grahams did in Washington. The Pulitzer did that as well. Hearst. That's fantastic. But if it's for other purpose, then it could be an issue.
Alberto Ibarguen, he'll be featured at the 1913 opening dinner of the 100th anniversary celebration of the Manship School next week. In fact, it's next Wednesday when Mr. Ibarguen will be coming from Miami to Baton Rouge. Now, you also served at one point as board chair of PBS, correct?
I did.
How was that experience?
It actually felt like I was managing a newsroom, because, as you probably know, people in newsrooms are industrious and extremely independent thinkers, and the PBS system. It's, by the way, it's the Public Broadcasting Service. It's not the Public Broadcasting System. As a service, it is a federation, and the federation includes 300-some independent stations that are funded largely locally. And so it really was like running a kind of United Nations. I admire the people who have been the CEOs. I was the volunteer chair, so I was not the one directly responsible. But it was a fascinating experience with stations whose needs and challenges could be as different as the upstairs, downstairs producing stations like Boston, and the very, very small stations from Alaska, for example, or in other rural parts of the country, and everything in between, 300 of them. So it was always a challenge. They're all also, like in newsrooms, they are driven by principle. They're driven by the need to serve the information needs of their communities, and I think that that makes them people that I want to support.
What about federal funding for public broadcasting? There's a call, and there has been for some time, to do away with this, particularly from conservatives. There's this gentleman running for the U.S. Senate here in Louisiana, Bill Cassidy, who said he wants no federal funding for public broadcasting. He's not alone. If it goes away, does that end PBS as we know it?
I don't think it will end PBS as we know it. I think, let me say this. First of all, I don't agree. I think in fact, I believe we had an even better public broadcasting system when the federal government supported it even more than it does now. So my personal opinion is that we are well served and would be even better served if the system were better funded. So putting that aside, if you did take away the federal funding, that would take away, I think, something. I don't know what the current numbers are, but they used to be somewhere in the 17 or 18% range. So that, yes, it would certainly have an impact, but I don't think it would kill. I don't think it would kill that broadcasting, which is largely supported by members and by other contributions.
Here's a question from a listener. Haven't we been wondering who to trust in the media ever since the radio age began?
I think if you look at some of the penny newspapers, if you look at some of the kind of newspapering that went on at the beginning of the 19th century, just before radio, you would say to yourself, we have probably been wondering who to trust from even before Gutenberg.
What did you think of the coverage of the government shutdown? Was it fair and balanced?
I don't think fair and balanced was so much the issue. I think I wish the coverage had been more about the substantive issues. This is a common refrain I think you'll hear from people like me. I wish the subject had been better covered so that we had more explanatory journalism and less journalism about politics of it, the horse race aspects of it, who's doing what, the soap opera parts of it. Frankly, they got the most coverage. I would say the same thing about the coverage of Edward Snowden, the fellow who disclosed all of those secret documents. I would have preferred coverage about what do those documents say about what our government is doing, what do those documents actually do, what was the actual effect of those disclosures.
297-5633 is your number. We'll spend a few more minutes with Alberto Ibarguen, the president of the Knight Foundation, when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A bit more time with Alberto Ibarguen, president of the Knight Foundation. He will receive the Manship Prize next week at LSU as the journalism school celebrates its 100th anniversary, and he will be on hand to discuss the future of news, and that's what Mr. Ibarguen is doing right now with us at this time. Barry in Mid-City. Good morning, Barry. You're on the air.
Good morning. With a wonderful show again, Jim, I'd like to ask what the role of advertising has to be, because there are now several newspapers around the country that are like community newspapers that will not receive advertising, so that there's no pressure, if you will, upon the print reporting.
What about the role of advertising?
I really appreciate, as a former publisher, I really appreciate the question, because it goes right to the heart of how we afford what we have to have. We have to have, I think we can agree, in a democratic society, we have to have the free flow of information. The First Amendment guarantees free speech and free press. It does not guarantee that you'll have a good business by it. We found a model, particularly in the second half of the 20th century, we found a model that was largely advertising supported. And I would say the great newspapers were powerful enough as business organizations and as institutions in town to be able to resist, by and large, resist undue influence from advertisers. Smaller papers were not, in some instances, but by and large, it worked. When that model fell apart, in part because of the greater efficiency of the web, in part because of the growth of...
I'm sorry?
That has begun the search for a different model. Barry's question, I'm sorry to call you by your first name, I didn't catch the last name, but Barry's question, I think, is really right on point with what's happening now as people seek new models. So, for example, the Texas Tribune is basing its model on membership and events, creating events that people go to, creating a membership in the publication, which is, in a way, like circulation. And so we're dependent more on other sources of income rather than the advertising that you used to see when you turned a page in the newspaper.
Bruce in Walden. Good morning, Bruce. You're on the air with Alberto Ibarguen. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, a couple of thoughts, just questions, really. Is a friend of mine wrote a paper while she was at Manship on don't blame people for the degradation of the news, which seems to be one explanation that, you know, people really like stories about kittens and blue lights on the evening news. But her point was that this is really something that has to do with, consensus among the powers that be about what people ought to be hearing. So I wondered if you'd comment on that.
I think there's no way around it. People do like to see pictures of kittens. I think that's proven. But I think there's also a need in the community for civic information. There is... and that need has always been paid for in our country. Well, I shouldn't say always, but in the last 75 years was paid for by advertising in the paper that supported. Investigative journalism has always been expensive and has never really paid for itself in most publications. What paid for it was the advertising and the convenience of subscribers paying for the paper. We have to find another model for that. And I wish there were some easy answer I could give you, but there's no way that you're going to be able to do it unless you can create either niche publications that charge high cost, or mass publications that
I don't want to say make their money on the kittens, but the newspaper that I used to publish had as many readers who went to it for sports and the funny and the comics as they did for the local news. But the advertising paid for both.
Alberto Ibargüen, last year, actually it was earlier this year, very early this year, the governor of Louisiana floated an idea to tax media advertising. It's not a new idea. He ultimately backed away from that, but what would that do to the media?
I believe that would further depress the business. I'm not sure. I think you could also make some arguments there about First Amendment, I suppose, but I think these are businesses that are already extremely stressed, so that if you add another tax on top of that, there's no question it would just simply create more stress on publications.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, and we look for you next week at LSU. Alberto Ibargüen, the president and CEO of the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim.
Appreciate
a privilege. Thank you.
Our honor. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. We have two guests to discuss the aftermath of the government shutdown and the reopening of the doors to government on Capitol Hill after 16 days of nothing happening as a result of Congress and the president negotiating right down to the wire as the country faced a default. That's been diverted. The debt default will not happen, at least not now. But have they just kicked the can down the road? And who are the winners? Who are the losers in this crisis that was averted in the final hours of negotiations? Clay Young, political consultant from Baton Rouge, and activist Faye Williams, joining us from Washington, D.C. Faye Williams, let's begin with you. You're right there in the heart of the action, or lack of action, over the last few weeks. What's your perception about what happened and if there are any winners in this sordid affair?
Well, good morning, Jim. How are you? First of all, I think the people were the losers for at least those couple of weeks, and some of them will feel the impact of closing down the government for a long time. The good part about what happened is I think a lot of the critics of the president, a lot of the critics of government will understand that government does many great things, many wonderful things. And when they found themselves without those benefits, they understood, yeah, that comes from government. I mean, I'm often just absolutely floored when people say, I don't want government in my business, but then they are waiting for their Social Security check or their veterans check or their, you know, some other kind of check. Even some of the members of Congress who were responsible for closing down the government get checks, you know, for their farm, for failure of the agriculture, or for what have you. Many of the ones who were criticizing government were accepting checks from government before that shutdown, and I'm sure they'll go right back to doing the same thing now that government is reopened. I'm sorry that the resolution is so short, but hopefully there are some people who learned a lesson and we can avoid the trauma that we put the American people through in the last couple of weeks.
Well, of the eight members of Congress from Louisiana, the two U.S. senators, Republican David Vitter, voted no. Mary Landrieu, the Democrat, up for re-election next year, voted yes. And in the House, Cedric Richmond, the Democrat, lone Democrat in the Louisiana delegation, voted yes, along with Charles Bustani, Republican from Lafayette, and the other five members voted no. So I guess that's 5-3.
Well, you know, we've come accustomed to not relying upon Louisiana to help to make improvement in the U.S. government. I mean, Louisiana is having its challenges taking care of its own people. And, you know, I guess they could use the help, but until you get leaders who are more progressive, who understand the role that government does play in the lives of those who need it most, we'll have this kind of voting. I, of course, you know, played my role in trying to change that some years ago, but I see that it hasn't changed a lot. I'm just grateful for the three who did vote to reopen the government and to help to straighten out these problems in which we've found ourselves by our critics who are not doing anything to help to resolve the problem.
Well, I guess it was Fleming, Cassidy, and Scalise who voted no, along with David Vitter. The open seat in the 5th District is up for grabs tomorrow. It's Election Day. But as far as the political ramifications and whether that will impact future negotiations of this kind, Clay Young, what's your take?
I think, and good morning, Jim, and good morning, Faye. I think that there is going to be an impact. But, you know, Louisiana has skewed so Republican over the last few years. They're the only statewide elected Republican Democrat here is Senator Mary Landrieu. All of the statewide elected officials are Republican. And to your question about winners and losers, I would have to agree that that in Washington, none of the political class won. I think that the people did lose. And so often, it seems like Washington on both sides talk beyond the American people, and the bickering is so what bothers people. You know, I was looking at a composite of all of the polls across the country about the direction of the nation, and overall, you know, the number is 74.9%, and overall people are dissatisfied with what the politicians in Washington are doing. Congress has a disapproval rating of 82%, nearly 83%. And so I think it's the dialogue that so turns people off. I think most Americans, Republican or Democrat, they just want results. And we begin to see people being turned off when the bickering starts. And I think for elected officials moving down the road, I think they've raised the apathy quotient, Jim, where people are just saying, you know, we can't trust anyone because they all seem to be out for themselves.
Well, a story that is among a few front page stories today in the New York Times about this aftermath. It says on talk radio and in the conservative blogosphere, the bipartisan vote on Wednesday to reopen the government without defunding President Obama's health care law was being excoriated as an abject surrender and betrayal by spineless establishment Republicans. So is there a big schism in the Republican Party, Clay?
Absolutely. There is a movement by many of the older establishment Republicans, older in terms of time in Washington, and they didn't want to see this thing happen. John McCain and people of his ilk wanted this not to be so devastating because of the overall impact on the party. There is indeed a one side that tends to be more aggressive in rhetoric, that takes the Ted Cruz route of addressing what's happening in Washington, and a bit more of a reserved approach. And I might suggest that when you win elections, you generally work to get your side motivated, but then you have to woo the middle. And people in the middle generally listen to those who have the best ideas and the best way of articulating that. I think the Republican Party now has to figure what is going to be its direction. If it continues to be this one side wanting an all-out kamikaze attack and the other side saying, let's not do much, you're going to have a hard time motivating people to go to the polls and say, this lady or this guy who represents this party is someone that I can stand behind.
And you know, one of the good things, Jim, I think that we found out, those of us who are progressives, is that there are some good people in the Republican Party. I mean, maybe we don't agree with everything that they do, but we see when the, you know, deal was going down that there were people who came forward with some amount of decency, like Mr. Dent, Mr. McConnell, Miss Iott, Mr. McCain, Senator McCain. We learned to appreciate them in terms of their efforts to try to help to meet us in the middle and come to some kind of resolution of this matter. So, you know, I never thought I would see the day that I'd be complimenting Mitch McConnell or even Senator McCain. But this week I'm just feeling kind of grateful for the role they played in helping us to come to, a settlement of this matter, even if temporarily so. And I think that's what we all have to do, is try to find the good in people and praise it and compliment them when they do something good, especially if we have condemned them when they've done something with which we disagree.
And, you know, if I may, Jim, on a couple of notes. First, on the government shutdown, and raising the debt ceiling. These are not new subjects. We've seen these before. Lifting the debt ceiling is a story that we've talked about on a number of occasions. And depending on which party is in power, you often have the other side saying that it isn't a smart move. It is irresponsible. We've seen Democrats do it to Republicans when Republicans were in power. And, you know, we saw it recently. So depending on what's happening on any given day, the arguments shift depending on who's in the minority and who's in the majority. And as it relates to the president's health care law, you see an overwhelming number of Americans who say the health care system is in need of some form of improvement, some reformation. And I think where Republicans miss is while people are concerned about some of the newness of the Affordable Care Act and what it is going to do, instead of targeting the issues that Americans are concerned about, it became too much about President Obama. And like it or not, on the right, the president holds more popular than many of the Republicans in math. And all so right. I think the approach should have been application and not so much just the personal attack of the president.
How did the president come out of this, Faye Williams? Did he come out stronger, weaker, or about the same?
Well, I think for the moment he came out stronger. We never know, you know, with this Congress, what's going to happen day to day. But I think yesterday when he came out, he made the speech. First of all, he thanked the people who worked in government and talked about, you know, how valuable they are to service. I think that was a smart move on his part. And I believe he picks up some supporters, even from maybe Republican staff, when they saw that their bosses were there trying to make life more difficult for them in terms of taking away their health care and other things. I think he probably gained some friends. Now, whether he can hold on to them or not, but I think he made the right decision to come out and talk about what his three priorities are for the next few months, the first being the budget. And I think if we can resolve the budget issue for a longer period of time, then that debt ceiling problem will go away. Because
all right, hold tight. We're going to take a few calls. Dorothy in Goodwood. Dorothy, you're on the air with Clay and Faye. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi, good morning. The way I see it, the Republicans are the ones who lost big time because they lost face because of a few raucous members, and nobody was willing to stand up to them. I mean, you can talk about your moderate Republicans all day long. The problem is none of them stepped up to the plate to stop this nonsense.
All right, Clay, your response.
You know what? I would say that there were no winners. I think the president came out about the same. I do think the Republican Party took on water because of the way that this ended. But I would encourage people to understand that the rhetoric used by some is what turned people off. I quite frankly don't think people have a problem with anyone standing by their core convictions. I just think the way they went about it was what was damaging. And we've seen that iambic shift depending, again, on who's in the majority. So people standing by their principles is not something that I think is horrible. In fact, even the president said that, you know, he understands people will stand their ground.
297-5633, back in 90 seconds with Faye Williams and Clay Young on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane producing. Your number is 297-5633. A bit more time with activist Faye Williams, former congressional candidate, and Clay Young, a political consultant and commentator. And they're commentating about the aftermath of the government shutdown and the reopening at the 11th hour as Congress averted a debt default. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, do you believe the budget problems will continue as long as the Republicans are beholden to the Grover Norquist no new taxes pledge?
Why don't we start with you, Clay, on that one?
I missed the last part of what you said.
About the Grover Norquist pledge for no new taxes. Is that making it hard for the Republican Party to maneuver on these kinds of issues?
Not necessarily. For me, it goes back to the rhetoric again. I mean, it's not new to hear Republicans take an anti-tax position. But I just don't think that people, even on the right, want to be associated with some of the name-calling that goes on. And I'm sure the same thing can be said on the left. You know, we've seen – you remember when in the early 2000s and the Democratic Party was trying to find its voice again after the end of the Clinton administration? It took some time, but they were. Republicans are going to have to do the same thing, but they're going to have one clear direction. It's either going to be a party that's led by that emotional Tea Party faction or some of the establishment, and it's unclear which will win.
Now, Faye Williams, is there a distinction between being against taxes generally and being against any tax that comes up that involves renewal or a tax that we haven't seen before? What's going on?
Well, I think we're responsible, Jim, for taking care of the needs of the American people. And I think when they vote for certain candidates, that says where they are. If it means that we need to borrow, if it means that we need to create more money, or if it means that we need to cut out something to get something, that's where we're missing out. Everybody wants to hold on to their little, whatever, their little piece of the pie and not want to give any to those who may be in greater need. I think, though, if we can put together a budget that reflects some of the needs of all of the people, we'll be able to resolve this problem. And the other thing is, we're having a very civil conversation this morning, and I really appreciate that, as well as the callers and all. But I think, you know, even though Representative Peter DeFazio said when he was midway through his remarks the other day, and he held up that small blue-edge mirror facing across the room and said, "If Republican colleagues will look at me, I'll show you who is responsible." I think each of us needs to turn that mirror to ourselves, too, to see what we can do. What
Absolutely.
Is it we can do without, or what is it we can give on, so that those who are in greatest need will get what they want.
Martha in Jackson. Martha, good morning. Please be brief. You're on with Clay Young and Faye Williams. Hi, Martha.
Yes.
You're on the air.
Oh, I think I'm on a different show. I'm listening to somebody talk. Oh, yeah.
All right. I think we've got a problem there. JCC, what's going on with Martha? Paul in Opelousas. Paul, good morning. You're on the air with Faye and Clay. Hi, Martha. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Jim. Just a short question for your guest. Just like Social Security went through the thing and Medicaid went through it back in the day, do you think this is over in the next election with the next president being elected, let's say he's a Republican or she's a Republican, do you think this killing of the Affordable Care Act is over and we'll move on to something else? Or do we see ourselves, after signing up and getting it, going through this fight again of trying to kill it?
I don't think it's over, but in terms of the success of undoing the Affordable Care Act, I don't think we'll have that done. I would imagine after having voted over 40 times to try to kill it and not being successful, there's still somebody out there. In fact, Senator Cruz from Texas has said this is not over. Other senators have said this is not over. So they'll go on, but I think in terms of the success, it will not happen. And as the president said, as soon as the Affordable Care Act is successful, it won't be called Obamacare anymore.
Clay?
To be brief, I don't think that it is over. I think that the Affordable Care Act is law. I do think that over time you could see some of the details change about how it works. I mean, that's just government, but the Supreme Court has backed it now, and so it is indeed the law of the land. In terms of the fight over it, if the fight polls high, you'll see people fight using it as a weapon of choice. And if it doesn't, then maybe not. But I don't think the fight over it is over. It just the approach may change over time.
And the president has always said, if there are problems, let's straighten them out, but let's not kill health care for people who are in need of it. So he's willing to make the changes, but just not as a matter of attaching it to this budget.
297-5633, Faye Williams and Clay Young for a few more minutes. And JC says, let's give Martha another shot. Martha in Jackson, you're on the right show, right time. What's your question? Martha? Can you hear me? Apparently not. Okay.
Jim.
Yes.
If I may, I think that one of the big discussions that's going to have to happen in Washington is about the way the government goes about handling entitlement. And I don't mean to say handle entitlement and you slash and burn everything. I do think that if we can have a civil dialogue about the way that money is disseminated and how we are taking care of people who are in need in our country, and there are clearly people who are in need, but we never really get to the discussion on a civil level like this because there is always so much rancor and screaming one side to another, and it's difficult to get to the truth because people are screaming things at each other on a personal level.
And, you know, I think if we can get to that jobs bill and get more of the American people working, then we have fewer people that we have to deal with on some of the on some of the social services. I think that's a big thing we have to do. And I don't think anybody will mind confirming that people are indeed in need of something, you know, just as was passed in this last bill, that little bit about verifying that people need the health care. So I think we just got to get to work on that, getting America back to work, and that's going to resolve a lot of our problems.
Daniel in Sherwood Forest. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air. Good morning. Daniel?
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Sorry. Thank you for taking my call. My point is probably not germane to this discussion, but the thought was the name-calling that's going on in Washington, D.C., and the little girl that committed suicide over bullying, it seems to me that politicians set the tone for bullying in the United States, and it just goes on down the hill to kids. I know that's not germane to the budget, but I think it's important. Thank you.
I think the caller is right, Jim, and I think that's one of the reasons I appreciate the fact that several people have tried to bring down the tone of the rhetoric, including the president's speech on yesterday. There was no yelling, no screaming, and, you know, taking each side taking some blame and talking about where do we go from here. I think that's what we've got to begin to do, rather than just talk about the past and beat up on each other. Where do we go together from here?
Clay?
I actually would disagree with that to a great degree. I think that, yes, there is arguing that goes on in Washington, but I'll be honest, you know, bickering and name-calling goes back, you know, further back than Abraham Lincoln. I think it's a tragic situation when children are bullied and we have outcomes like the one with the little girl. But I hold parents more responsible and the adults around those kids more responsible than I do some politician in Washington.
All right, speaking of volatile statements. Yesterday on this program, we had Smiley Anders and Lauren Scott, and they both were in rare form. JC, let's start with a snippet from Smiley. He was talking about the opposition to the President of the United States, and Smiley Anders contends that much of it is race-based.
I think you're going to see that. You're going to have a Southern enclave where they won't vote for someone like Obama. I think a lot of it's race, and you're going to have this, but I think it'll be like a little country of its own that's out of step with the rest of the United States.
Okay, Faye Williams, Smiley Anders saying the South has taken a different approach to the president, and in Louisiana, for example, he's gotten less than 20% of the white vote in two national elections that he won going away. What's going on in your home region?
Well, you know, I fall into that same category. I know it's been some years ago since I ran for office when I got perhaps about 99.9% of the black vote, but only 27% of the white vote. But, you know, I'm appreciative of that fact, and I think that Louisiana has grown in some ways. I think if I ran today, perhaps I could gain more white votes because they would not totally look at my race. I've probably become even more progressive than I was when I ran then, but I still think that perhaps I have learned how to gain votes, to talk about things other than, you know, just what I want, but rather what the people want. And I don't think the people care who is getting for them what they need. So I would concentrate on that more. But I'm sorry, in terms of state level, I still see a lot of problems in Louisiana, and there need to be some changes. But more people need to come out to vote. People who don't vote have to take some of the responsibility for what they're not getting that they need.
Clay, is the opposition to the president in Louisiana, for example, is it to some degree race-related?
I got to be honest about that. I've heard that from a great number of people, and I think to say that every person who disagrees with the president or the majority of the opposition to the president is because he's African American is both ridiculous and demeaning to the president. The president of the United States didn't get to where he is because he's black. To say that there aren't some people there who wouldn't vote for him because of the color of his skin, I mean, that would be terribly naive. But Republicans have had problems with Democrats and vice versa for years, and to couch the entire opposition to him as being totally race-based, I think is demeaning to him. I think he would tell you that he didn't get to where he is just because he's black. And I think comments like that only serve to bring the level of dialogue down. It doesn't help anyone to say that. And it's too easy. It's too easy.
Well, in Louisiana, Bill Clinton won two national elections here by landslide margins. Barack Obama has lost two national elections by landslide margins.
But it's different now.
How's it different?
Well, the rhetoric is different now. Over the past 10 years, pre-Barack Obama's presidential election, the tone of the rhetoric has gotten so much more personal, starting midway through the Clinton administration on. And we've seen both sides act in a very unstatesmanlike way toward one another. And again, I would give to you that there are probably people out there who have problems with President Obama because of the color of his skin, but you say that every person who disagrees with him does so because he's black, I just think that's irresponsible.
Well, it might be 10%, and if it's 10%, as you know, Clay, you work elections, 10%, if you give it away going into an election, it's hard to make up that ground.
But could you say the same thing for people of color not voting for a white Republican because they don't want to vote for him because he's white? I mean, I think that people are a little better than that.
Think, Clay, you would ever hear that because black people have voted for white people almost all of our lives. It's just in recent years that we've had black candidates that we could vote for in many positions. You know,
I agree with you. I agree with you. And I'm saying nobody says that because the argument would be ridiculous. And again, I'm not telling you that there aren't people out there who have problems with President Obama because of the color of his skin. But to throw that umbrella over all of the opposition and say they're all disagreeing with him because of the color of his skin, again, I just disagree with. I mean, I'm only one person, but I disagree with that.
Mark in Sherwood Forest. Good morning, Mark. You're on with Clay and Faye.
Good morning, Jim. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Question is, what part do they think the media play in progressing of the discourse in the politicians when we have 24-hour networks and one network, 24 hours, constantly bashes the president, have guests, they call them all kind of names, and I just believe they're fueling the discontent and the divisiveness that's causing the politicians to...
All right, what about the media? Clay, do you think the media are more conservative or liberal? Do they affect the discourse in America?
Absolutely, on both sides. The media is it's focus group media, and it does happen on both sides. Fox News that skews to the right, of course, and then an MSNBC that skews to the left. They both are responsible for firing up their base. And as you know, Jim, in this game, it's about getting eyeballs and earlobes. If you can get more people listening or watching, you know, you can increase your bottom line. So, yes, the media plays a part in it. And largely, I think the media can often be irresponsible.
Faye, what about the media?
Yeah, well, I can't disagree with Clay on that. I notice when I go down south, I get awfully depressed because it seems that every time you walk into a hotel room, you walk into any public place, Fox News is on, and I just immediately get depressed. And as a progressive, I can come home and turn on MSNBC, and things start looking up for me. You know, it just seems to be more positive. So I guess it depends upon what we relate to. And I can't. I mean, I would be stressed out all day if I listened to Fox all day. And I'm sure people who are on the right wing would be stressed if they listened to MSNBC all day.
All right. Here's Lauren Scott, the LSU economist, on this program yesterday, commenting on media bias.
The idea that you guys are that you folks in the media are not biased is ridiculous. I mean, that is ridiculous.
That's Lauren Scott, and of course, he believes there's a liberal bias. Clay Young, Do you buy that?
I think there is a bias both ways, depending on what you watch. There's enough blame in that regard to go around, and quite frankly, that shouldn't be an excuse for an American not to be informed about whatever they're going to vote on. If the media is the total source of your opinion forming or the total education for you on an issue, then I actually blame the voter, not the media.
And, you know, I think we all have to listen to more than just our favorite station. Even though I say it stresses me out, I still read The Guardian. I read The New York Times, The London Times, you know, the conservative newspapers. Because I do think if I'm going to comment on something, I at least need to know what the other side is saying.
Phil Fay, we got a roll. Clay Young, thank you. Fay Williams, always a pleasure. Let's talk again soon. And a reminder that the 2013 edition of the Uncommon Thread Wearable Art Show is tomorrow at the LSU Museum of Art. Until Monday, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.